supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now showing Martin Kippenberger, The Problem Perspective, at moma.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose Chancellor Special Lecture Series presents The Aesthetics of Race in Middle Class America by James D. Anderson on Tuesday, March 31st at 7:30 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum. Information available at www.cas.illinois.edu.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in today. In this portion of the program, we're going to take a look at the private security contractors in Iraq. Our guest is Washington Post foreign correspondent Steve Faneru. His reporting on how contractors operate outside laws governing the U.S. military was honored in 2008 with the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. The series of reports served as the basis for his new book, Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. Faneru notes at the outset of the book that the contractors fighting the war are a parallel army. They're there because it was clear early on there weren't enough troops. He says hundreds of companies formed overnight, forming, in his words, like mushrooms after a rainstorm, some with boards of directors and glass offices, others scarcely more than armed gangs. There are some 300 companies employing tens of thousands of contractors in Iraq. Most of them are not American. Steve Faneru's title, Big Boy Rules, comes from the way the contractors refer to the unwritten code they live by. Late in 2008, however, they were stripped of their immunity from Iraqi law. Also late last year, the U.S. government unsealed its case against five private security guards employed by Blackwater Worldwide in a 2000 shooting in Baghdad. The 35-count indictment charges the defendants with killing 14 unarmed civilians and wounding 20 others. A sixth guard has pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter and attempt to commit manslaughter. Steve Faneru is a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. His book, Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq, is published by the DeCapo Press. Steve Faneru, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Security contractors, mercenaries, you chose the word mercenaries for your title. How did you make the choice?
Well, I felt that it was really important to call the practice what it is. These are people who are in essence, they're fighting the war for money. That's the primary reason they're there. There's been a lot of debate and a lot of controversy over the use of that word, and the people in the security industry have said that it's inappropriate because in some instances, in many instances, we're talking about people who are they are Americans who are working in support of the U.S.-led coalition, and according to their understanding, that those people then should not be referred to as mercenaries according to the definition that's offered by the Geneva Conventions. My feeling was that in most of these cases, in nearly all of these cases, these are companies who are hiring not only Americans, they're hiring people from other companies, from other countries that have nothing to do with the Iraq war, places like Fiji and Peru and Colombia and Chile, and they're fighting alongside these same Americans who are doing the exact same work. And so, as I understand it, they're sort of claiming that, well, perhaps those people are mercenaries, but some of the other people are not. And I felt that was parsing it too far, that the primary reason these people are there is for money, and it's mercenary work.
Mm. In the book, you tell one of the stories you tell, an anecdote that's quite telling, involves a woman by the name of Kate Bateman, who was a student at Johns Hopkins in international studies. And in 2005, she had the opportunity to question both Donald Rumsfeld and then President Bush about the rules of engagement for private contractors. How did she come to ask the question, and how was she answered?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. Her then fiance Bob Bateman, now her husband, was a major in the United States Army, and he was stationed in Baghdad, and he was traveling through Baghdad as a civilian, and in a civilian vehicle. And that vehicle encountered a Blackwater convoy, Blackwater being the security company that's been involved in so much controversy. And the Blackwater convoy ran his car up onto the sidewalk and then proceeded to fire shots into the air, terrifying everybody in the surrounding area. He was infuriated. Bob was infuriated by this because, he felt like, these are people who are supposedly on our side. We're trying to, to win over the Iraqi population, and yet they're antagonizing everybody who gets in their way. And he told this to Kate, who just coincidentally happened to be at Johns Hopkins at a time when Rumsfeld came to speak. And so she got up to ask him, what are the rules that apply to private military contractors in Iraq? And Rumsfeld really didn't know. He sort of stammered out an answer that Iraq was essentially a sovereign nation, and so sort of implying that the contractors fell under Iraqi law, which couldn't have been further from the truth. So a few months later, President Bush himself showed up at Hopkins, and Kate again got up to ask the question, and she asked, what are the rules that apply? And Bush literally said, sort of self-mockingly, "Help." He had literally no idea what the rules were, and I think it is telling because it really shows how little the people who were running the war actually knew about this enormous private force that had mushroomed on the battlefield in Iraq. And it was an issue that really haunted the coalition for well into the war.
How common are these kinds of incidents? The one that involved Bob Bateman, for example.
They're extremely common. I mean, that was a fairly benign incident. The contractors and the military, it should be said, often drove on the wrong side of the road for security reasons. It was easier for them to keep track of sort of who was around them. And, of course, Iraq at that time, 2004, 2005, 2006, was an unbelievably dangerous place. But that was common. I mean, I saw it numerous times myself, and I was in convoys where it happened to the civilians who were being affected by the movement of the convoy in which I was traveling. But also common were shooting incidents in which private security contractors would be faced with what they perceived to be a threat, and then would fire directly at civilians, and then in many instances would actually hit them.
Yeah. Now, we have this act called the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, MEJA. And as I understand it, that's how these charges were brought against the Blackwater guards. What is this act? How does it apply? Because we seem to think about these security contractors as operating without rules and without laws. But then we have MEJA.
Right, exactly. Well, basically, MEJA is a civilian contractor law. It applies to contractors who are working in environments where there are conflict environments where they're under contract to the U.S. government. But in 2004, L. Paul Bremer, the former head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, the U.S. occupation government, signed an edict granting immunity to all contractors under Iraqi law. It was never clear after that happened what laws, if any, applied to the contractor's actions, whether they fell under MEJA, whether they fell under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is the military criminal justice system. And it had never been tested. There was a lot of people wrote about it and a lot of people speculated about it, but no one was ever actually charged. The Justice Department, in the wake of the Nisar Square shootings, in which Blackwater allegedly killed at least 14 people in a Baghdad traffic circle, has used MEJA to try to prosecute this case. Now, Blackwater is already contending that they, as a State Department employee, did not fall under MEJA, that they were essentially above the law. As I understand it, they are arguing that basically the rule of law was that there was no law. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. It's very complicated because, in part because of the diffuseness of the contracts, the proliferation of the contracts, there were so many different thousands of private security contracts that were signed in Iraq. Blackwater worked for the State Department, but dozens of other companies worked for the Defense Department. Other companies worked for other companies under subcontracts or for the Iraqi government. And so there's been a great deal of speculation and confusion about sort of which contracts might or might not fall under MEJA. And as I understand it, Blackwater, the defendants are arguing that they, in this case, did not fall under MEJA. Mm.
Our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, Steve Faneroo. He is a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. He covered the war in Iraq from 2004 to 2007. He is the author of Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. The title Big Boy Rules comes from the way the contractors refer to the unwritten code they've lived by. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I teach the courses here on international law and human rights at the College of Law. And I've been qualified as an expert on the laws of war now 5 times in U.S. military court-martial proceedings over the years. And I have to agree with your author. I haven't had a chance to read his book. The vast majority of contractors in Iraq are indeed mercenaries under the laws of war. The only exception would be they have to fulfill 2 requirements. And that is, one, they are citizens of the United States, and 2, they are engaged in official missions of protection for the United States. For example, protecting State Department employees or something of that nature. Other than those fulfilling both conditions, they're all mercenaries. Second, even if they fulfill the 2 conditions— and technically are not mercenaries, they're still bound by the laws of war and can and must be prosecuted for committing war crimes in Iraq, as the Blackwater people did and are currently being prosecuted by the United States government. Indeed, it is our obligation under the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Regulations of 1907 to prosecute contractors, all contractors, whether mercenaries or not, who commit violations of the laws of war in Iraq, such as killing civilians, as happened in the Blackwater incident. So I do want to say I'm very happy that WILL has someone on here to promote the argument, the correct legal argument, that the vast majority of these contractors are indeed mercenaries, unlike that person you had on the other day who was hired by a law firm representing these mercenaries and came on here to try to argue that they were not mercenaries. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Steve Hainery, you want to respond in any way?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing I would add is that I always found, in addition to really wanting to call the practice what it was, I felt that the term itself, the sort of accepted term, which I would add is the term that's used by my own newspaper, you know, private security contractors, I could never really figure out what that meant. It seemed to be a term of war that sort of obscured more than it actually explained. Like a lot of terms that we hear in conjunction with the Iraq War, like collateral damage, and to refer to the casualties involving civilians, or improvised explosive devices, to refer to the incredibly damaging roadside bombs that have been used in Iraq. And so, for me, that was another reason why I really felt like it was important to use the term in the book.
One of the things that you say in the book, and you say it in a number of ways throughout the book, is that it's kind of hard to get your brain around the idea of war as a job.
Right.
Talk with us a little bit about how it's different being a contractor or mercenary, if you prefer, from being in the military.
Mm. Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And you know, before I started to research and report on the private security industry, I had spent a considerable amount of time in Iraq with the military. And, you know, I traveled all over the country with the military. And it was I was not in the military myself, and it was the most that I'd been exposed to the, you know, not only the what was happening in Iraq, but the, sort of the military culture. And, you know, I guess I was enormously impressed and continuously impressed by the professionalism of it, by the dedication of the people who were involved, by the self-sacrifice of the people who were involved. Most of the people I met were in it for any number of reasons, but they all felt a very strong connection to the people who they were fighting with and the institution itself and why they were there. When I started to look into the private security industry, it was interesting because many of the people who were in that industry had been in the military themselves and had many had even fought in Iraq. But it was just a completely different ball game. People had different loyalties to their companies and their colleagues. You could walk away at any time, and people often did. They'd hop from contract to contract. If they got a better offer, they'd simply leave, many in the middle of the night. And it was sort of an accepted thing that, you know, that was something that you did, and that you were in it for yourself. You know, I think that was another real major difference, that you were there because of whatever personal reasons had brought you to that job. For most everybody, the bottom line was money. But then it went beyond that. People had very, you know, personal issues. They were either running from something, or they were there for the adventure, or they believed in the war and they wanted to support it in another way that would allow them to make more money. But the difference, the sort of selflessness and self-sacrifice, I think, that you see in the military, and the sort of inherent selfishness that you see with the private security industry, I think that was really striking to me.
Mm. Well, now let's talk about this young man by the name of John Cote. He'd done a tour in Afghanistan and a tour in Iraq in the 82nd Airborne. When you met him in Iraq, he was a mercenary and all of 23 years old. How did you meet him?
Well, I met him on my first assignment covering the private security industry. At that point, I knew – it's interesting because I had been in Iraq for 14 months, and I still really knew almost nothing about it. And so my goal was to just learn more and get with one of these companies and try to find out sort of what they did and who they were. And I made a connection with a company called Crescent Security Group. It was a small company that was, you know, maybe 50 people, that was based in Kuwait and made runs into Iraq every day. And so that's how I met John. He was working for this company, and by the time I met him, he was extremely disillusioned. You know, he'd been with the company for a few months. It wasn't anything like what he expected. It was incredibly dangerous, and the company was unbelievably corrupt. You know, they ran around Iraq in these sort of semi-armored vehicles that looked like they had come off the set of a Mad Max movie, and they were really flimsy and not safe at all. They had in one instance, had their entire cache of weapons stolen and then had to buy new ones back on the black market. They smuggled weapons and liquor back and forth across the Iraq-Kuwait border. They employed Iraqis who they really had no idea who they were. They just sort of filled out the teams, and they paid them about a tenth of what they paid people like John. And so he was thinking about going back to school, where he had been in the military for 4 years. He had done combat tours in Afghanistan and Iraq, and then had gotten out and enrolled as an accounting major at the University of Florida. And he found that he just couldn't deal with it. He like thousands of people who come out of Iraq, he had some kind of post-traumatic stress, and so he had gotten offered this job to go to Iraq for $7,000 a month. By the time I caught up with him, he was thinking about going back to school because he was really disillusioned by what he was seeing.
Yeah. Now, when he was at Florida, it seemed to me he just couldn't cope with it. He felt older than everyone, and also, though, it seemed he had a need to be in a danger zone. And it made me wonder about this, about the transitions for soldiers coming home. You know, your brain can change. You know, it can rewire itself. And we often think about traumatic brain injury. But here this young man, I would suspect that maybe his brain was reworked a little bit.
Well, I think everybody who was in Iraq, I include myself, had their brain reworked a little bit while they were over there. And, you know, it was a familiar, the story that he told me was familiar. You know, I had seen parts of it in myself, and I had seen parts of it with lots of people, you know, people in the military, people, reporters, you know, people who had worked as contractors. You know, you come back, and there's just no way you can replicate the intensity of the life that you lived over there. And, you know, John hated the military. He hated all the rules and yet, you know, there was clearly something missing from his life. He was already an adrenaline junkie before he ever went to Iraq. And when he came back, you know, he was thrust into the setting, you know, the University of Florida. It should have been utopia for him because, you know, he's an incredibly good-looking guy, very charismatic. Then, you know, he had a million friends, and yet he told his closest friends and he told his brother, you know, he felt totally alone. You know, he said he felt like he had already lived two lifetimes compared to all these sort of, you know, pampered kids who flocked around him at Florida. And I have to say, I think this is one of the most perverse aspects of this entire phenomenon. You have people like John who are coming out of Iraq and they're damaged, you know, and they're trying to sort it out when they come back to the States. You know, they have difficulties finding outlets for that. And here's this industry that was created and in many ways sanctioned by the United States government that gets them, that allows them to go back to Iraq to work out whatever the issues are that are plaguing them when they're trying to reintegrate into civilian life. And to me, that was always an extremely dangerous proposition.
Mm. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, Steve Fainaru. He won the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for a series he did for the Washington Post, which is the basis for his book, Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take another call now. Champaign County, line one. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. The other place in the world where the U.S. has a large number, certainly not approaching Iraq, is Colombia. And in the House and the Senate, and mainly in the House, through Jan Szakowski of Evanston work, the number is known. It's specified how many that can be, and there's a ratio between the armed advisors, quote-unquote, that we have in Colombia. There is nothing comparable that I know of, and I've heard so many shows about the mercenaries, and nobody gives a figure on how many there are. Now, I have a figure from a gentleman, in activist in northern Illinois, who's working against the Blackwater compound, 600 acres or something, for training, quote-unquote. He has a website, noprivatearmies.org. He says that there's about 35 or 40,000, and these aren't the people that are washing the spuds. These are the people that are actually contracted to either State Department, some quasi-official construction firm that's got a contract, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's no central information on this. Can you speculate? Is that close to what's right? And no one also talks about making sure they withdraw when they talk about withdrawal from Iraq. What do you? I have a number of things here, but I don't know.
Yeah,
if there's other callers
are,
that defer to
these them. These are really excellent points. You know, the government has never known or quantified the exact number of mercenaries who are working in Iraq, and I think that's just simply because they don't know. I mean, this is an industry that it really grew because of supply and demand. There weren't enough troops. There was an incredible lack of security, and so these companies just rushed into the vacuum and started hiring people by the tens of thousands. You know, the Pentagon finally came up with an estimate of 25,000 about a year ago, and you know, that alone is a huge number. I mean, we're talking about more than an additional division of private troops, if you will, on the battlefield. Many people feel it's considerably higher. And, of course, it varies according to demand. And so, you know, the people I ended up coming to trust the most were the people who had been in the country the longest and in the industry the longest. And I think that the estimate that your friend gives you is pretty accurate. I think it's probably between 30 and 50,000. I think we're never really going to know because there are a lot of companies. You know, the government recently came out with another figure that there are more than 300 companies that have been operating in Iraq, but those are the ones that even the government knows about. There are a lot more companies that are operating just completely off the grid, and you know, we'll probably never know about those companies or what they're doing or, you know, or sort of what they've been involved in. But I do think the 30 to 50,000 figure is, you know, I think that's a pretty good ballpark. You know, the other issue of what's going to happen to them when the drawdown occurs, you know, it's a question that no one has really answered, and it's really a question that should be placed directly to President Obama because, you know, while he was in the Senate, he was very active in trying to bring about regulation for the private security industry in Iraq, and yet he hasn't talked about sort of what will happen with Blackwater, for one, whose contract is up in the spring, and, you know, more broadly, what will happen to the private forces that are there as he begins to execute this drawdown. You know, the private security industry was sort of looking forward to it the last time I was in Iraq a year ago. They felt that with the expansion of economic activity in Iraq, you know, and the continuing security demands, that there were going to be lots of business opportunities for them. And, you know, as one of the officials who represents the industry told me, he said he felt like it was just going to get better and better for them. Now, you know, whether that's the case, you know, a lot has changed since then. A lot has changed just in the last month. So we'll have to see.
The status of forces agreement, one of the things that was fought about, includes no provision for these mercenaries and other military contractors. In fact, American troops who aren't specifically on combat training will be subject to Iraqi law, and I wonder whether that might dissuade them from thinking that it's they certainly shouldn't be able to be as wild and wild, wild west kind of thing. I mean, the video of this British mercenary just taking pot shots at passing cars that was right. Taken a couple of years ago is astonishing. I don't know how you react to that, but specifically, I wonder whether you followed the case of Donald Vance at all. The Wikipedia site seems pretty good on him, and it has a link to his testimony before a Democratic policy committee in the Senate. That is just a chilling story. He was an FBI informant, unpaid for the company against the company he was working for, because they were smuggling guns in to Iraq, and he was extracted by American forces, thinking he was being saved, and then he was subject to the light torture torture lights regime of no sleep, loud music all the time for 75 days. And he apparently he lives in Chicago, I understand, and he's writing a book on it, but there's not very much talk about it, even though he gave his testimony in open hearing of the Senate.
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with the case. Was he extracted by an American private security company or?
And I'm sorry, but our caller is gone, and I was about ready to say I've got a number of other folks waiting.
Sure.
So, but that's an interesting case. We could look into that here on the program, and maybe we could find something, and maybe it would result in a program. Let's take another call now. A listener in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Yes, fascinating, and I'm very glad that you do use the term mercenary to refer to these individuals. What I was and the companies. What I was wondering was, from what I understand, Dick Cheney, when he was the Secretary of the Defense in, I believe, 1991, that he was the one who signed the papers enabling the privatization of the military, i.e., the development of this mercenary trend. And I was wondering if you could speak to that a bit. And also, I'd heard something that now maybe I'm misunderstanding your interpretation, but I'd heard that there could have been at one point as many as 124,000 or 126,000 quote-unquote contractors, which I interpreted to mean mercenaries in Iraq at one point. So maybe I completely misunderstood the report that I'd heard, but I'm just wondering what you can say about the out of control character of employing these people, and also how it might affect the morale of the U.S. troops, who obviously are making a pittance in comparison in
right.
salary.
Right. Well, those are all really. Really good points and really important questions. I'll just sort of take them as they pop into my head. With regard to the numbers, you know, there's been a lot of confusion over the numbers. There are 190,000 contractors of all stripes working in Iraq, and those include, you know, cooks and engineers and sewage disposal experts and, you know, bomb disposal experts, a whole range of of professions, people who are under contract to the U.S. military. Now, the mercenaries are a subset of that group, and they form, as we said, about, you know, probably about 30 to 50,000.
Right. These actually are mercenaries hired to kill, in other words.
Well, they're hired. They do all kinds of different work. You know, they some of them protect supply convoys, and they're out on the roads, and they're getting involved in combat that way. Some of them, like Blackwater, they protect the U.S. ambassador and other State Department diplomats who are running around Baghdad. And then others of them are just protecting, stationary objects like, you know, military installations and like the Green Zone or warehouses or, sort of stuff all over the place. The interesting thing is, With regard to Cheney and the policy, yes, Cheney, Rumsfeld, they were involved in what has been a continuing privatization of the military, a downsizing of the military since the end of the Cold War. What I argue in the book, though, is that that's certainly part of it, and that was part of what was going on in Iraq at the beginning of the war. But what happened in Iraq, I think, is very specific to Iraq. The Bush administration, including Rumsfeld, simply failed to provide enough troops to fight the war that Iraq became. And when that happened, the administration simply lacked the courage, the political will, to add the more troops, to impose a draft or start sending tens of thousands of more troops into Iraq to deal with the deteriorating security environment. So what they did instead was they simply rented themselves a private army of these mercenaries that included these hundreds of different companies. And those companies filled the security void that would have been filled by the military if there had been enough troops. So I really do believe that this phenomenon, this Iraq bubble, as people came to refer to it, where you had this enormous multi-billion-dollar industry that sprung up overnight in Iraq, was very specific to the failures of the administration at the beginning of the war. With regards to the last point, which I think is also a good one the military, within the military, I think there was an enormous amount of resentment about the use of these forces for exactly the reason you pinpointed. They were simply making a ton more money than the people who were doing almost the exact same work. But I think it was even more than that. You know, the mercenaries would get involved in firefights or questionable incidents in which they shot at or even killed Iraqi civilians. And then invariably it would be the military that would have to come in and clean up the mess. You know, the Blackwater incident is just sort of the extreme example of that, you know, where they killed apparently 14 people in this traffic circle, and then it's the U.S. government that had to and the Iraqi government, and of course the Iraqi people themselves that had to end up dealing with it. So it's a sort of a multi-pronged thing.
You don't see a connection between Halliburton and its activities in Iraq with the larger history of Richard Cheney?
You know, I sort of tend to not fall into the conspiracy theory category. I think Halliburton certainly had connections to the administration, obviously, with Cheney. Halliburton was a logistics company, and, you know, one of the things that about Iraq that was unbelievable was, you know the enormous amounts of money that have been spent, when you actually see it in action, it's, you know, it's awesome and breathtaking and disturbing, you know, to see that much, the amount of money that's being spent. It's like Iraq sort of turned into a money-making machine. Now, Halliburton was in a favorable position to get that contract, but I never felt like Iraq was a pretext for getting these companies and Cheney himself a lot more money. I was unwilling to take it that far.
No, I would actually, but maybe not on the level that one might possibly.
Could you just repeat what you just said?
Yeah.
To the caller, I'm saying. I'm sorry.
In terms of Halliburton, that the ideology of Vice President Cheney probably contributed to this. In other words, privatize Iraq. Iraq, of course, would be democratic, i.e. would become privatized, all the more it has been historically. Will be an ally, and will be able to help Israel, et cetera. A whole series of levels that they thought they would profit from this, literally and figuratively, I think.
Right. Okay. I agree with that.
Okay. I want to thank the listener for his call. We're going to take another call now. Caller in Urbana, line 3. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd like to thank you for using the term mercenary, because I think it's entirely appropriate. One of the earlier callers mentioned that Blackwater now has a training ground here in Illinois, up in the northwest corner of the state. And what they seem to be doing is trying to diversify, that they'd like to get into the business of training police officers. And it seems to me they're particularly unqualified for this type of activity. But it seems very popular with police officers.
Right.
In Illinois, they're not certified, and therefore a police force or police officer using their training cannot be reimbursed by the state, or they can't be given any credit for it as to required training. But it seems to me that people aren't aware of this. They should be aware of it, and this is not... not just Blackwater, they're perhaps a particularly egregious example, but mercenaries are thus not suitable people for training civilian police forces. The other thing that they seem to want to get into the business of is a reaction to emergencies, hurricanes, disastrous events, earthquakes, and this sort of thing. And again, it seems to me this is the sort of thing the civilian official should be preparing for and not trying to bring in outside groups to handle.
Interesting comments.
That's my thought.
Yeah, okay, let's go back to our guest, Steve Faneroo.
Well, I agree that the Blackwater is certainly trying to diversify. I mean, I think the thing that's really important to remember is that these are private companies, and their primary goal is to make money. And so when they go to Iraq or when they go into New Orleans, as Blackwater did during Katrina, you know, as they go into Illinois, you know, it's all for the goal of making more money. And I think in Blackwater's case, you know, I think Blackwater, Eric Prince, the chairman, he sees the writing on the wall. I mean, Blackwater's days in Iraq are clearly numbered. And, you know, the company has made at this point about $1.5 billion off the war. That money is going to dry up very quickly. And I think it may also dry up in Afghanistan. And, you know, Blackwater is part of a much larger State Department contract that includes two other companies, Triple Canopy and DynCorp. And that contract, although the bulk of the work has been in Iraq, it's all over the world, and it seems extremely unlikely to me that the new administration is going to get in bed with Blackwater after everything that's happened. And so I think all that work that's going to be tied up with the U.S. government is going to suddenly dry up, and so Blackwater is looking for other avenues to generate revenue. And I think the questions about the appropriateness of what they're doing and using them are the questions that we should be asking.
Mm. On the other hand, we're in this situation because there weren't enough troops.
Exactly. You know, it's an interesting thing because I think when you really start to get into the weeds, it becomes a much more morally ambiguous question. And the example I always give is, you know, for now, Blackwater, for example, wants to get into Darfur and to serve in a sort of peacekeeping role there. And they've argued that they can do that. And I don't really have any question that they could. And the question I always raised was, well, if we went back to 1994 and the situation in Rwanda, where the world sort of stood still while, you know, 500,000 people were slaughtered, and you had Blackwater at the time, which at that time didn't even exist, if there was a company like Blackwater that came forward and said, we can stop the fighting, we can stop the genocide, we can do it, we'll do it for, you know, $20 million, which would be a pittance compared to what it would take a government, you know, who would be able to stand on their soapbox and say, oh, no, they're mercenaries, let these people be killed? You know, I wouldn't be willing to do that. And yet we know that, you know, they're now getting involved in functions, especially in Iraq, where they're actually fighting the war. And the question I always raise is, do we want to outsource the responsibility for deciding who can kill and die on behalf of our country to a company like Blackwater? And you know, I think it's a very tricky proposition. But when you start getting to concrete examples, whether they could save people's lives, I think it starts to get really murky.
Yeah. Also, it seems that the American people were largely untouched by this. I mean, in terms of, we don't have to go. It's a volunteer operation to become a member of the military. So we're kind of out of the, we really don't have a good handle on,
right,
on it that way. And one of the things that I was struck by in the president's inaugural address is that he tipped his hat, so to speak, to the men and women in the armed forces. He said, we remember with humble gratitude those brave Americans who at this very hour patrol far-off deserts and distant mountains.
Right. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I mean, the sacrifice that we have asked of our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, no matter how you feel about the war, to see it up close is really unbelievable. I mean, we're talking about people who have done, at this point, some people who have done four, mm-hmm, even five tours in Iraq. And those army tours, you know, 12 to 15 months, you know, in incredibly difficult conditions. So I don't think anybody would sort of take issue with what the president referred to in his, you know, in his inaugural address. I think the real question is, it's not only that. I mean, we've taxed these people. We've taxed the military to the limit at this point. But we've also used a parallel force, a parallel army, to obscure the true cost of what the war is. Mm-hmm. You know, I make this argument in the book that, you know, when you use a private army to fight your war, you know, you don't have to count them. And you don't have to count them when they're killed, which the government doesn't, and you don't have to count the troop levels because they're not counted, and you know, you don't even have to acknowledge really that they're there. And in the case of the president, I think for a long time he didn't even know that they were there. And so I think it creates a whole bunch of issues about how we fight our wars. And I do feel this way about Iraq. I mean, Iraq is not Vietnam. I mean, Iraq is a war that for most people in the country, there's been almost zero sacrifice. And it's sort of like existed on the margins of our nation's consciousness. And the private security industry helped keep it that way because we didn't even have to know what they were doing. So I think that's another issue that we have to sort of grapple with if we're going to use these types of companies in the future in our armed conflicts.
Do we have any idea of how many private security contractors have died?
Well, all we know are the number of the contractors that have a fraction of the number of contractors that have died. There's a thing called the Defense Base Act, which is a form of insurance that's required of companies that are under contract to the U.S. military or the U.S. government in Iraq. And when claims are made under the Defense Base Act, they're routed through the Department of Labor. It's a sort of almost a form of workman's compensation. And when that happens, the Department of Labor has produced casualty figures, and the last casualty figures I saw for contractors was something on the order, this is all contractors, not just mercenaries, but something on the order of 1,200 people who have been killed and more than 8,000, I believe, who have been wounded. But I think that's a fraction of the real totals, because there are lots of companies that are totally off the grid and don't have Defense Base Act insurance. You know, John Cote, the guy we talked about earlier, we didn't really discuss it, but he and his colleagues were kidnapped and then later killed on Iraq's main highway. Their company, Crescent Security Group, did not have Defense Base Act insurance, and so they're not included in any casualty figures, not the contractor casualty figures, and not, of course, the U.S. military's casualty figures.
Well, there we have to leave it. We're out of time. Steve Faneru, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Steve Faneru is the author of Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. The series of reports he wrote for The Washington Post served as the basis for this new book, his second. He won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting in 2008 for his work. Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq is published by the DeCapo Press. And that interview was first aired on January 23rd of this year. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. It's 1:53. Dave Dickey joins us now with settlement prices from Chicago and Kansas City.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Wheat and corn showed positive gains on the day, be they single digit. Meanwhile, over in the soybean pit, it was a tale of two different sets of months. The nearbys showing weakness, while the deferreds showed some very modest growth. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars in Kansas City. May wheat, a high on the day, a 563, a low of 552.5, settling 560 up 5. July, a high of 574, a low of 563.75, settling 570.75, up 4.75. May wheat at the Board of Trade, a high of 518, a low of 507.25, settling 514.5, up 6.5. July, a high of 530.75, a low of 520, settling 527, up 6.25. December wheat, a high of 578.5, a low of 569.5, settling 576.25, up 6.5. July of 2010, a high of 599, a low of 594.5, settling $6.5, up 7. May corn, a high of 392, a low of 386, settling 390.75, up 5. July, a high of 402.5, a low of 396, settling 401.25, up 5 as well. December corn, a high of 424, a low of 417.5, settling 422.75, up 5.25. March of 2010, a high of 436, a low of 429.5, settling 435.5, up 5.75. July, a high of 448, a low of 444 and three quarters, settling 447, up 5 3/4. Let's go out to December of 2010, a high of 438 and a half, a low of 435 and a quarter, settling 438 and a half, up 5 1/4. May Oats, a high of 197, a low of 191. The contract settled on its high for the day, up 3 1/2. July, a high of 205 and a half, a low of $2 1/4, settling 205 and a half, up 3 1/4. May Beans, a high of 962, a low of 941 and a quarter, settling 944, down 7. July, a high of 956 and a quarter, a low of 937 and a half, settling 940 and a half, down 5 1/2. November Beans, a high of 889, a low of 876 and a half, settling 880 and a half, up a half. January of 2010, a high of 896 and a quarter, a low of 889, settling 890 and a half, up a half. Take it out to July of 2010, a high of 913, a low of 912 and a half, settling 912, up 1. November of 2010, a high of 913, a low of 909 and 3/4, settling 908 and a half, up a half. May soybean meal, a high of 298.70, a low of 289.40, settling 290.80, down 350. July, a high of 293.10, a low of 284.70, settling 286, down 260. May soybean oil, a high of 33.80, a low of 32.94, settling 33.60, up 23. The July contract, a high of 34.05, a low of 33.23, settling at 33.88, and it is up 21 on the day. Trade estimates are in for next Tuesday's planning intentions report. The national corn average guess is 84.269, the average soybean guess 79.765, and the all wheat guess 58.598. Remember to tune in at 6 minutes past the hour when we'll discuss the marketplace on the closing market report. We'll have CME Livestock in just a moment. This is Dave Dickey.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson in Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
The livestock contracts finished lower today in Chicago. April live cattle, 85.05 the high, 84.25 the low, the settlement 84.27 and a half, down 35. June, 82.70 the high, 81.75 the low, 81.85 the settlement, that down 62 and a half. August, 83.50 the high, 82.50 the low, 82.67 and a half the settlement, that down 65. October, 87.30 the high, 86.25 the low, 86.30 the settlement, that down 82 and a half. March feeder cattle, 93.60 the high, 93.35 the low, 93.40 the settlement, that down 35. April, 94.35 the high, 93.15 the low, the settlement 93.42 and a half, down 80. May, 95.75 the high, 94.50 the low, 94.95 the settlement, that down 42 and a half. August feeder cattle, 98.60 the high, 97.40 the low, 97.45 the settlement, that down 87 and a half. April lean hog, 61.30 the high, 60.25 the low, 60.52 and a half the settlement, that down 72 and a half. May, 72 even the high, 71.30 the low, 71.57 and a half the settlement, that down 105. June, 72.45 the high, 71.50 the low, 71.77 and a half the settlement, that down 95. July, 73.55 the high, 72.52 and a half the low, the settlement 72.70, that down $1. And May bellies, 86.